accession number 19667, reel 4.
Anna's Lichtelm, reel 4.
So, fairly early in the morning, it must have been, we arrived at Narbonne. And from there, we had to go to the next place. Now, that was it. I can mention it any time.
Perpignan?
Perpignan. Oui, c'est Perpignan. We had to find a train to Perpignan. We all split up. And I couldn't see anywhere an indication for Perpignan. Mind it, there were so many rail settings, just like worse than Paddington. Now you got to go to this part or to that part to find just different trains. In the end, I decided I'll ask a Frenchman. Monsieur, direction Perpignan, s'il vous plaît. And a policeman just happened to come past. He looked around, looked at me, and I thought, well, yeah, don't take any notice. That's the best way. And he directed me so-and-so down there, and that was on the other side of the station, more or less. And there we found each other back again into the train, of course, the four of us. Funny enough, I'd never had very much trouble with my nerves, otherwise I wouldn't have been here at the moment. The one who was most nervous was Onnekink, because he knew that if they caught him, that would be it. You know, he definitely would have been shot. Well, of course, we probably would have been shot as well. But anyway, he was very, very nervous. And that's the sort of people I admire. The ones who are nervous, but still do it. Those are the heroes. Really. You always find that. Anyway, eventually we arrived at Perpignan. And, of course, what's the exit like? What does it look like? We had split up again. We all would find our own way, so the control. Just ahead of me was a German naval officer. I thought, ah, that's the one. I'm walking next to him, and I go just after him, I go through the control. Anyway, the others didn't, all of us for nothing, because absolutely everything was all right. You know, no control, no people, no Gestapo or whatever. Unless they were there, and we looked all right. I had still my calfskin dispatch rider's jacket on, my coat. I had boots which were ski boots. But anyway, it didn't seem suspicious to anybody if they had been there. And then, of course, our man from Miranda had already been there once before. So he knew the town a bit more, and he was the one who spoke, because he had been in Miranda quite some time, at least a year, I would think, or more, and knew a bit of French anyway. He said, we'll go to the harbour, that's the best place, because nobody, you know, will look for you there at the harbour. And it was about time that we had something to eat as well. Well, we first went into one of these real harbour cafes, built of wood, and it looked really setting of just fishermen, etc., and dealers and goodness knows what. We went into this place and had some soup. Well, the soup was made of starfish and some other unknown creatures. I know my brother had some of it. I didn't have more than a few spoonfuls of the damn stuff. So all I ate, and most of us, except the one from Bunyan, he could eat anything because he used the terrible food, of course, in that camp, and not enough of it. And we just ate our bread, as much as we could. At least we had a meal, we had something to eat. Because we hadn't eaten since we left the monastery. So, in Perpignan, we had to go and see the doll's doctor. Monsieur Docteur de la Poupe, I think it was. And he was the one in the organization. We went to his house, which I thought was rather dangerous. And, of course, that must have caused the trouble later on. And we were told how we had to go. We had to take a certain bus to a little place near the border. And we took that bus after dark and had to do a certain distance. Perpignan is not that far from the border. But several miles before the border, we had to get out. And surprising how many people lived around there, or seemed to live around there, because half of them were Poles, and a few Jews, and us, So the bus was empty after that, really. We were told, if you follow us, and we happen to be at the end of the column, if somebody on a bicycle comes, it's border patrol, it's Germans. If there's a man walking, it's one of the people of the district. It went on for a while, and we were the last one in the queue. Suddenly, the others had disappeared. And a cyclist and somebody walking came along. So that delayed us. And we tried to catch up. And we called out. And we thought they were calling us. And the sounds were, ooh-hoo, ooh-hoo, ooh-hoo. So we went into the direction. But then we found that suddenly, ooh-hoo, ooh-hoo, came from somewhere else. And it happened to be
owls.
There happened to be owls. By that time, we completely lost the others. So we went on for a while, and we didn't know how far the border would be. We didn't have any idea about... That was, of course, just my brother and I, who were there, the last ones. The others were just still with the main group. I decided, what are we going to do now? How quickly will we hit the border? We went a bit further, but thought, we've got to be careful. Let's go into the woods and use our compasses and keep south. If we find we've got to go to the left a bit, after that we go to the right a bit. And from after the right a bit, we go to the left a bit, etc. We went on. The woods were not too thick, but mostly shrubs. And my God, what a lot of thorns all these shrubs had. Terrific. Suddenly we came to a little ravine, about 3-4 meters deep. And I said, how are we going to cross that one? If you go to the left, and I go to the right, and then we'll see whether we can find a place where we can go down and up again. And I found one, and then suddenly I had a yell from Wim, my brother. I went to him, and he said, I put my foot, twisted my foot, in that little hole there. So before it would start swelling up, a twisted foot, I pull off his boot. And then the pain started. So what are we going to do? He couldn't really walk. We still had two sticks. I forgot to tell you that. In Geneva, we had met a man making furniture who was Jewish. Believe it or not, he didn't want to believe the stories about which we knew in Holland and I knew in Switzerland. The same the nurse I had in Switzerland, she was Jewish. She wouldn't believe the stories about the Jews. They just couldn't believe it. But anyway, we went to him. We bought some walking sticks, mountain walking sticks, with a good thickness. And we asked him to hollow them, to split it, cut it, and make them a bit shorter, so that we could put our passports in there. And we had to take the outside of the passports off, because otherwise it wouldn't go in. And he kept on saying, yes, but are we allowed to do that? Am I allowed to do that? I said, yes, police knows about it. You are allowed to do it. Typically Jewish, worried to hell. Absolutely worried to hell. And anyway, he did it for us. Well, I think, when was it that my brother cracked his stick? I think probably when he fell. Yes. So I gave him my stick. But he still couldn't move. So we went back to my side, leaning on my shoulder. It was his left foot. So he was leaning on my left shoulder and using his right foot and using my stick as well. We kept the broken stick, which I kept. And he got out, he got through somehow with help. And we got to the other side. Of course, we couldn't put his foot back, his shoe back, because that was, by that time, swollen up so heavily that we used all we got, a jacket, and tore it up, and we put it around his foot, and above his foot, his ankle, everything, because we still thought it twisted his ankle. In the next 1.5-2 hours, we suddenly hit on a farm. Because how we got there, he used to hobble on one foot, one leg, for say about 100 yards. And then I used to take him on my back and go a few hundred yards until I was tired. Then that's how we went. And we suddenly, in that sort of circumstance, we hit on a farm. So again, he kept away from the farm as far as possible. And I said, I'll go to the farm. And banging and banging on the door. And eventually, a very sleepy voice came in French. And believe it or not, it was the guards, the guy, the people who were supposed to have, you know, who we should have gone with, the guy, I can't think of the word.
The guides,
that's right. And they let us in. So I called my brother, I picked my brother up again and carried him in. So we had to stay there several days, and several people came, mostly Poles. I think we must have been nearly a week there, and hoped that my brother's foot would get better, of course. One of the Poles was a doctor, one of the groups, because it was every night going over the border. And they, in the morning, they brought back espadrilles, that are these slippers of shoes, which are made of jute, plaited jute, about 3/4 inch thick, and a canvas on the top. You probably know them, you know. We still can buy something like it nowadays in the shops, which are very silent, of course. You know, even if you hit a branch that you crack, it sort of subdues the sound. So ideal for that sort of escape. Anyway, we stayed there several days. And luckily enough, that night, the Jews had gone. It was just us and the Poles left. The new intake of Poles. When suddenly there was a hell of a radau, the German word. German soldiers all over the place. We were in the cellars. We were sleeping in the cellars. And where we had slept for several days. One night, even, we always used to have the army type of blanket over our faces because there were rats running around. One night, I felt a rat. I was still asleep, awake. I felt a rat walking over my feet. I gave it a kick and he landed on top of my face, or at least with the blanket in between. Yeah. And that morning, suddenly all these soldiers came and they were upstairs. They put their bayonets through the floorboards, through the seams of the floorboards, and we could see them. And just to one pole next to me, I said, "Yeah, I got this dagger, you know." Right. Then they left with the farmer's helper, the farmer himself, and I think nobody else. The wife stayed behind. So when we heard that they'd gone, we went through various cellars under the farm and went through a hole in one of the walls. Outside, made sure that there was no sentry there left behind. And then we made a run for the woods, which was a steep hill, fairly steep hill, or about 25 degrees, something like that. But not too many trees in it, and the trees were not too thick. They were only about 6 inches in diameter. And I'd taken my brother on my back. He weighs 14 stone, and I was 12 stone in those days. And we were running up this hill until we came. I looked around so now and then, and I thought, now, there are not enough trees between us and the pass where the Germans had been. Up we go, further and further, until the hill started rounding off. And there the Poles had waited for us. And we decided what we're going to do. Well, actually, at that moment, my brother hobbled on one foot to where the Poles were waiting for us. And he went much faster than me because I had to catch my breath. As you can imagine, we had walked hundreds of yards up this hill, steep, and he was 14 stone. So, you know, I was absolutely knackered, completely knackered. I couldn't walk for a moment. And until I'd caught my breath, and then we decided what we were going to do. We had a common language, which I think was German, the Poles. And they decided to go back to Perpignan. I said, "God, that is dangerous." He said, "Yes, but we've got to catch people before they get caught. Go to the..." Because the Germans must have wound up the whole organization. "So we've got to catch them before they go and get caught." I said, "For Christ, be careful." And we decided we had to go to the border somehow. Well, that morning, was a lot of fog around between the hills. And we decided we have to go eastwards first before we go south to the Spanish border. Because we were most likely to get caught by Germans knowing exactly how to get to the farm, you know, which must have come from the Spanish border. So we went east. First through woods, and then through the mist or the fog to a big open plain. But nobody could have seen us because of the fog. And then in the next woods, we waited, and I said, well, we got to have something to eat. I'll go back to the farm and see whether I can get some food there and some clothing for the cold night. And I left my brother there in those woods. I went back. I had to do very carefully because the mist was beginning to rise a bit. And I had to take good notice looking around where he was so that I would be able to find him back again, of course. But eventually I did get within a few hundred yards of the farm. And I saw the woman, the farmer's wife, come outside on that side of the farm that we had left and was doing something like feeding the chickens, I imagined. And I came a bit closer and attracted her attention. La Boche, La Boche. But at the moment, there were no Germans there. So I went a bit closer, and she said, the Boche come every time. Be careful, stay away there. So in hiding, I'll get some food and I'll get something, some blankets. She came with two blankets, one big one and one a bit smaller. And had in the small one, she had put tins of sardines, bread, and goodness knows what. I said, that's lovely. I said, careful. She said, they're going to shoot my man and they're going to shoot our helper. You know, that's what they probably told him. First, of course, they would interrogate him and all that sort of thing. But that's what they had told her, they were going to shoot him. And then I found, coming out of the first woods, I couldn't cross the plain because it was beautiful weather. It's fantastic sunshine. And of course, from the border with glasses, they could have seen us, they could have seen me, and would have wondered, of course, who that was. So I had to wait until later on when it started to get dimpsy, which is a Devonshire word, until it got a bit darker, until I could cross the open plain, which I did very fast then, of course. And I found my brother. And I know, we nearly cried, you know. And he thought that I had been caught or wouldn't come back for some reason or another. And of course, he would be there with his bad leg, you see. Anyway, I think we left behind the cracked stick and only had my stick. Which he, of course, he had been using, you see. So we lost one of the passports anyway, which we later found would have been any good because we would have needed a visa for Spain. And we walked a bit further to the border that day, had something to eat, decided how long it would take us, at least 3 days to get over the border. So we split up our food that we had and some drinks which he had given us, some bottles. We split them up into 3 to 4 days so as to make it last. And we started to go further south on our compass, of course, as far as we could until it was getting too dark. Then we stayed the next day. We had a feeling that we were getting very, very close to the border. But we couldn't move that far, of course, with the way his foot was. And I think, yes, we waited until the next night before we started moving again. And we came to a river, which was on the bottom of a mountain or hill, enormous hill or mountain. And the water was rushing, you know, going over the rocks and was going as far as we could ascertain to the east, which would be the Mediterranean, of course. So, and the higher Alps, we were in the lower Alps, the Pyrenees en bas, and we had chosen, our route had been in the lower Alps, because some routes did go over the higher Alps, which were just even more dangerous. We waited at the bottom of this river, and we imagined we could hear singing in the distance. But we wondered whether it was really singing or whether it just the noises from the water. Now, we compared it with Die Lorelei in Germany. And we called it Die Lorelei. So we decided, well, the next morning, at daybreak, Betsy went to their border patrols because she had a feeling we heard cars moving, vehicles moving. That must be the Germans on a road, partly up the hill. And so it was. So we were timing. It was 6 minutes to the east when they would pass, and about 4 or 5 minutes to the west. So we had to get well up that hill, first out of the river bank, then onto the road, and then up the hill, and it gave us only 6 minutes. So we decided that was only way to do it. We couldn't do it in the night. That was too dangerous for my brother, you know, in case he would slip, because it was very, very steep. And in the morning, we did. We got about, of course, I was going faster than he was. We got about a few hundred yards up. That was his place. I probably got 250 yards up by first, you know, sort of carrying him and helping him. And then we heard him come back. So we just did lie flat and hoped that they wouldn't see us. Now, of course, the mountain was slightly rounding, so it could be that from the road they couldn't see us because the road was dug out as well out of the mountain. And one side was more dangerous than the other side because that was how the road was rounding. From one, that would have been able to see us better than from the other side. Anyway, they passed, and then we had another 4 minutes, and we went further, and their rounding, thank God, went on. And once that passed, and we knew we were out of sight, we started moving up slowly. Eventually, midday, we came to the top of the mountain, and I decided we hit a little pass, just about a foot, 10 inches, a foot wide, which apparently was made by animals. We thought probably goats, wild goats, or sheep, or something like that. And that one went down, slightly westwards and down. So he was going to take a rest after we'd had something to eat. And he was getting already a little bit more thirsty, which was, of course, the pain and the temperature from his leg. And I said, I'll go on as far as I can and come back. See that this path is going to the main road, which should be on our western side. And luckily enough, it was going in that direction. I went on until about 4 o'clock, and then I ran back again before noted when there were any paths diverging from the path that I'd been taking, you know, looking back, what it looked like, etc. So I